I want to talk to you tonight about God and the poor. I want to share with you three verses that are all by Jesus, all talking about the same thing, but the fact that Matthew, Mark, and John all quoted from the words of Jesus is an important factor. We want to remind ourselves of this fact, for ye have the poor always with you, Jesus said, but me ye have not always. Mark, for ye have the poor with you always, and notice this, whensoever ye will, ye may do them good. God, this isn't an either-or thing, that you'll either do good for God or you'll do good for the poor. But, he says, me you have not always. That's why this particular offering that he was being given was not inappropriate. And then John 12:8, for the poor always you have with you, but me you have not always. So here is a revealed fact. Here is something that perhaps you would not have known, and evidently a lot of the people in the world today don't understand this, that in an ever-changing world, some will be poor. Now we're going to be talking mostly about the United States of America tonight, because this at least is one place where I find over and over again the focus is that it's within our grasp. We can cure this thing. We can eliminate poverty. Let's begin then with definitions. Who are the rich and who are the poor? If you were to listen to how rich and poor are being described by the people that show up on the news, the common picture is of the idle rich. They have all their people doing all their work for them, and all they have to do is to figure out how to spend it on a beautiful yacht, a beautiful mansion, the next antique, and all these things that they have. And then, beside them, are the hard-working poor. But this hasn't been true since the 1890s. This is way behind the time. This is like the people that are always campaigning against slavery. And we haven't had that for a while here in the United States. Here's the fact. Today, the rich and the poor are most often the same people, just at different times. Those just starting on their careers are poor. There's poor Phoebe, starting her career in forensic medicine, soon to be a major motion picture. Got a lot of series on all those, right? But when they reach the top of their earning power, they're in the top 20%. So it's in a process. Here's a statistic for you. 3/4 of those in the bottom 20% in 1975 were in the top 40% by some point in 1991. 3/4. They moved. Now, come up to year 2001, a household income of $84,000 a year, ranked in the top 20% of Americans. Okay? Those earning a little over $150,000 ranked in the top 5%. When you hear these percentages about the idle rich and the people that don't care and don't have to work and all this type of stuff, realize that somebody earning a little over $150,000 is ranked in the top 5%. Now, granted, that's a pretty good income, but it's not the common picture of the rich. Those with high incomes are not always accumulating great wealth. Many are rich one year and not the next. So definitions. Who are we talking about here? let's prop, you know, set up a fake rich guy and hate him, and a fake poor person, and let's sacrifice everything for that person we invented, you know. Let's get real. So let's examine this question about the idle rich and the working rich. Let's look at the statistics here. Only 3.5% of Americans have a net worth of $1 million. Now, net worth, as you probably know, includes household goods, clothing, pension plan. These are not the idle rich. Here's a fact that may surprise you. More upper-end wage earners work than do lower-end wage earners. Now, it's actually fairly well balanced, but it's there's more. Considering those who worked full-time and year-round, all right? In the year 2000, 3.9 million heads of households were in the top 5%, 3.9, while 3.3 million heads of households were in the bottom 20%. So it's still over 3 million, less than 4, but there's more wage earners working than lower wage earners. It's hard to say. So my point here is this. Stop falling for the false definitions. Stop believing that there's people whose only work is to go to the boardroom, smoke cigars, and have people, you know, put out of work, thrown out of their apartments. What about all the poor? Well, only about 3% of Americans are in the bottom 20% over a period of years. As I said, they're in transition, up or down, and to say that they are in that bottom 20% for over a period of years, and they are in that bottom 20%, only 3%. And many of these are the professional poor. These are the people that work hard at getting welfare and handouts. This is not a huge problem, 3%. Now, you know, anybody that's suffering is a bad thing. But the revelation of God is that at any point in time, take a photo of people's earnings and some will be poor. The third thought then is, what causes the changes? And the answer that they would like to say is it's manipulated by the rich to keep the other people poor. But in an economy of competition, which we have here in the United States, the growth of new industry and technology displace some older jobs. Efficient businesses edge out those that are not. At any given time, in a competition, there are winners and losers in a competitive economy. Now, this competitive condition actually is the true war against poverty. Wealth is the only victory over poverty. Equality is no victory over poverty. See? Equality would be dividing everything evenly, and it ends up that everybody would have less than they would want. As wealth grows, businesses and technologies change. So what am I talking about? Well, when automobiles became mass-produced, it edged out the horse and buggy industry. I mean, just think of the whining, you know, for the master buggy whip maker who put his lifetime into doing this and so on. Yeah, but we don't need a buggy whip when we're driving our car. And the car was better. While cost more to put gasoline in than it did to feed them hay, I suppose. All in all, it was just a lot better. When electricity became widely available, it edged out the whaling industry. They were getting the oil out of the whales and using it in the lamps. I guess that made really good light in the dark. I'm happy they stopped killing the whales, you know. When personal computers became available, it edged out typewriters. You can still buy typewriters because some situations still need it. We were finding out that to do work acceptable to the United States government, you had to use a typewriter, put in carbon paper and the whole thing. But for the most part, the personal computers edged it out. So this is the true path to defeat poverty, to encourage growth, to encourage the change. And then for the people who were excellent at buggy whip making, to bring them over, train them in the area of automobile something or other. Maybe antennae making or something, I don't know. But the idea is that there's a place for them to go. It's not dead for them. Now, if you've spent your whole life learning about buggy whips, you may not be interested in that, but you're going to try to get your kids interested in the automobiles, because that's the future. Now, let me start picking on people. Number four, the false promise of ending poverty. Here's the fact of things. Politicians promise to eliminate poverty. God says we will always have the poor. One of them is wrong, and it isn't God. The War on Poverty is the name for legislation first introduced by President Lyndon B. Johnson during his State of the Union address, January 8, 1964, 55 years ago. America has had a major war on poverty for 55 years. Look around. It's still here. This has transferred literally billions of dollars from wage earners to welfare recipients. Instead of eliminating poverty, it has created an entire community of people dependent on the government for their livelihood. This is a way of life with these folks. I worked in insurance out in Denver when I was going to school, and my job was to go around and collect monthly their insurance premiums. I did that because they wouldn't send it in themselves. They didn't have any electronic fund transfer or that type of thing. And if I didn't get there right after the welfare checks came, then actually the very next week, all that money would have been spent. So I have to wait for another month. So this is a way of life. It's a way of life where some money is kept and used, but for the most part, these people have been convinced that everything's stacked against them, that they cannot make it on their own. I find this to be the most horrible discrimination I've ever heard of. The race that produced George Washington Carver and a number of other wonderful, brilliant people. Even today, look in the high-end areas of businesses. You're going to find many black people. And for a group to sit there and say, well, you owe it to us, and we can't make it on our own. You can. It's obvious you can. What's keeping you down is a welfare state. So why does it continue? Well, politicians want to have people dependent on them for their livelihood, because those people will always vote them back into office. And the politicians are not suffering poverty. They're making hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then they write their tell-all book when they're done, and make another $1 million and whatever it is, you know. You say, well, why aren't you concerned about the poor? God is concerned about the poor. God has an entire process involved in the Jewish economy when God was running things. His plan was gleaning. We have a gleaner's food bank today, and that's the idea of people that need food or an organization that does charity work and that type of thing can go and pick up food there. And so stores that have day-old things that they're not going to sell anymore, they give it to the gleaners, restaurants and so on. God's plan was gleaning. But if you understand gleaning, it means that your family is down and out and you need food. There was a place for you to go get food, but you had to do it. What this was, it was gave people an honorable work to support themselves when everything else had fallen through. Leviticus 19, 9 and 10. Here's God's command in the law. When ye reap the harvest of your land, ye shall not wholly reap the corners of thy field. It says, swing that around and leave the corners of the field unharvested. Okay? Neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest, things that fall off the wagon or whatever as you're harvesting all of this. If it falls, you leave it there. You're not allowed, God says, to go scoop it up, rake it all up, and put it in your wagon. Thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of the vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God. I'm the boss. I'm telling you, you have to do it this way. Well, there's a waste there, yes. But the waste was put to good use, not to the wealthy landowner, but to those who needed to step out and do this. Now, I suppose any of you who have read, at least recently, the book of Ruth, will remember that that was exactly the situation. And you have the older lady, Naomi, and you have Ruth, the younger lady, the daughter-in-law. And so the younger one went to glean in the field. And that was to get enough food for she and her mother-in-law, the person she was helping. That's the way the thing worked. That was gleaning. Now, the landowner was to have his men reap his fields in one sweep and leave all the corners and fallen crops for the poor to gather by gleaning. That was built within the law. Here was charity, but not a charity that eliminated honorable work. Politicians gain power by siding with those who are losing. I found this example. At one time in India, the Congress Party was in power in the state of Karnataka and out of power in the state of Andhra Pradesh. So two different areas, in power one, out of power. Both states proposed raising the price of electricity. An opposition party led street demonstrations against the Congress Party in the one place when the Congress Party was in charge and they were wanting to up the price of electricity. An opposition party led street demonstrations against them. But in the one where they weren't in power, they led street demonstrations against the party that was in control. I want you to think about what that meant. That meant that neither authority was actually operating on principle. They were against raising electricity. No, they were trying to poise themselves as for the underdog and took opposite positions at the same time in different states. They simply played to popular sentiment. This is the way this thing works. So when you have rich people funding demonstrations against rich people, you know something's up. Now, if that is not the focus of government, to eliminate poverty, what is the proper focus of government? Let's look at the proper focus of government, and God has given us pretty clear instructions about our relationship with the government. Look with me at 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. And he's talking about all kinds of men here, because he then says, for kings and for all that are in authority. And what are we praying for? That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. John Gill emphasizes here, at least so dispose their hearts and minds, the leadership, that they might stop the persecution, and so saints might live peaceably under them, enjoy their religious liberty, and be encouraged in their moral conversation, the moral way of life. We'll get this then. The divine concept shows what we should expect from government. We are not to pray for the government to supply our basic needs, but to supply peace and quiet so we can meet our own needs. God's meeting the needs of the believer, you see. But we want the peace to go to work, bring home a paycheck. That's the proper focus of government. Organize things, keep peace and quiet, so that we can go about our daily life and get things done. All right. My last point is this. The poor results of political policies to fight poverty. There is no new thing under the sun. They keep using these same policies. And they have very poor results. Not just ineffective results, but poor results. So politicians use three basic methods to deal with poverty. Here's the first one. Direct money transfer. Take it from the wage earner, give it to the welfare recipient. This rewards those who choose not to work and promotes a welfare state. The situation of a welfare state is that when the people can't work, that's who they are, and they only receive, then they are turning to other means, less legitimate means, to gain their money. And so you have the gangs, you have, you know, the ghettos and so on, notorious for their gangs and for training people in gambling and drug use and so on. So all of this, and just the fact that you're taking money out of the pocket of the wage earner, it contributes to higher costs, since businesses and wage earners pay higher taxes to supply the government with this money. Now, when costs go up, then society suffers. And who suffers most? People that have limited income. So all of the time they're taking money out of the people that are wage earners, increasing their taxes, then the money has to come from someplace. See, it doesn't materialize into thin air. It's not Uncle Scrooge's vast warehouse of gold coins. So it suffers with a large group of the idle poor, and they tend to illegal methods of getting ahead. The people that are hardworking and so on, they're interested in being left alone, work hard, and save their money. So direct money transfer, this leads to a bad situation. Secondly, the limiting of prices, wage restriction and price cost limitations. This reduces competition and results in so-called shortages and loss of quality. It was in the 70s, I believe, when we found all the gasoline shortages and all the stuff, and we have as much now as we had then, and as much then as we had before. It's just that the restrictions, these restriction of prices, limiting of prices, had a bad effect on the economy. When commodities are increasingly in demand, then the supply runs short. You buy it off the shelf and it's not on the shelf anymore. Somebody was just telling me that because of this winter storm coming up, they went to Kroger's and they had entire shelves that were empty. People would come in prepared for their hibernation, I think. So when they are increased in demand, the supply runs short. So then the increased effort to supply the needed commodities causes higher prices for a while. That's the way this thing works. They have to put on more people to make more stuff. With gasoline, when they would run short, and they have a process to pull the oil out of the oil shale. It's not the easiest way. You know, just punch a hole in the earth and the oil spouts up. You have to do some processing. You have to harvest the shale. You have to crush it. You have to put it in a sucking machine and get the oil out of there. And it works. There's lots of oil in the oil shale. But it costs more to do it. When the price of oil goes down, then they shut down the oil shale things, or they restrict it. But that's the way this thing works. So you pay higher prices when the commodities run short. So if the government artificially restricts prices, then they can't put on the extra people to make them more. They can't add to their cost the sucking of the oil out of the shale. So then the supplies run short. At that price, we can't fulfill the need. The suppliers then will cast about and find a lower quality, cheaper item that they can supply in its place. And very often that means buying overseas, buying the cheaply made stuff in places that's places what do they call them, the sweatshops, you know, that a lot of the people that are all about restricting prices are being aghast to realize that the cheap stuff they're buying now is actually from the sweatshops. And then the third and last is the raising of minimum wages. They say, well, obviously all we need to do is to tell them to pay more for the untrained workers. These guys that couldn't go through college, couldn't get their degrees, couldn't get their expertise and all that stuff. Just mandate that they have higher wages. Let me ask you to imagine that you are the business leaders and now you're buying your workers. You're trying to find a cost-effective worker to work for you. Now, raise the minimum wage so you can choose higher skilled people or low skilled people, and you're going to have to pay them the same or nearly the same. So you bring the lower skilled person in there, and it takes him longer to do the work The higher skilled person can get it done. So who are you going to pick? See? This is what the business does. If they must pay the lower skilled people as much as the higher skilled, it's foolish to hire the lower skilled people. You don't get as much good work done. So do you catch what this means? The ones who are supposed to benefit are the ones who suffer. The ones who got the higher minimum wage are not going to be hired. This is why labor unions support minimum wage legislation. None of their members make minimum wage. So, higher minimum wage prices unskilled labor out of the market. This is why the public school teachers' unions supports minimum wage, because it keeps the young, inexperienced potential workers out of the job market longer, and so they stay in school longer. It keeps the teachers' union members in demand longer. This is not to the real benefit of the ones who are supposed to have gained this. Then the cost of making things goes up if you're hiring minimum wage people, and so the minimum wage didn't give them any value because they had to pay higher prices for what they normally buy. So within the plan of God, there is that, like the gleaning and the care, the loving care for the poor, that handles this without making it legislation. And when we mess with the legislation, then it actually hurts the ones that we're supposed to be helping, because they can't see ahead as well as God did. God and the poor. Well, let's bow for prayer. Our Father, thank you for an opportunity to turn our hearts to thee and understand that your way is best. Men think that they can go around and alter the way things are, but in fact, they only do damage. Because it seems popular, they keep getting elected. Now I ask, Father, you might help us as Christians to recognize we're not just right-wing politicians. We're people who take a stand on the fact that there will always be the poor. It is not our job to help a government support legislation that eliminates poverty. It's not possible. Now, I ask that you might help us then, Father, to be the kind of people that are all for true charity when we have enough to give. And instead of letting the government handle it and we don't have to bother about it, we step up and take care of these things. But, Father, we pray that you might help us then to recognize that the great push we see today of using legislation to eliminate poverty is a fool's errand, one that cannot succeed, one that has not succeeded, and one that actually hurts the economy and therefore hurts the very people that are supposed to help. With heads bowed, eyes closed, I wonder if you would say, Pastor, I recognize that, in fact, I have been led astray by whoever is preaching this thing of ending poverty. I thought that was a better way of doing it. It's a socialist concept. Everybody benefits. But it ends up that nobody benefits. So I'm going to bow to what God says, recognize that the poor are always going to be with us, and I might be one of them, and then somebody else might be one of them. But it doesn't mean what we think it means. Pray for me. Help me to see it from God's point of view. That's your prayer. I wonder if you'd slip your hand up. Say, pray for me. Father, then we thank you for giving us the truth, sharing with us what we could not know, that which is of the future. And when Christ said that we will always have the poor with us, we know that that looks on down the line to the very end of human government. Now I ask that you might help us then to be wise, to be careful, to ask, be in prayer for our government, that they would stop attaching themselves to every part of our life, to leave us alone, to let us live lives quiet and peaceful and dignified lives that can serve you. We pray thy blessing then in Jesus' name. Amen.